The scripture reading this morning will come from Luke chapter 12, verses 49 through 56. I came to cast fire on the earth, and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. For from now on, in one house there will be five divided, three against two and two against three. They will be divided father against son and son against father, mother against daughter and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. He also said to the crowds, when you see a cloud rising in the west, you say at once, a shower is coming, and so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you say there will be scorching heat, and it happens. You hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time?
Good morning. Anybody else catch that? We're reading a passage about weather and the thunder sounds. God approves this message. Yeah, be careful. Very glad to be with you this morning after a week of vacation. It's good to go spend some time away before school starts in and let the kids know that we still like them before we send them away to school and don't have to see them anymore, as we did this last week, and got to go to Branson and spend some time there. Appreciate very much Devin filling in for me. It may surprise you or it may not. There's not a long list of people who sign up to fill in for me when I'm gone, so I appreciate those that are willing to do it and are very grateful for it. You may think I'm a bit confused this morning. You would be right, but not for the reason you suspect. My sermon title is Master, Teach Us Peace. And in the passage that was read for us a moment ago, Jesus said, no peace for you. Not going to have it. Not only will there be no peace, I'm going to set the world on fire and burn it down. It sounds like maybe I'm a bit confused about what that passage is about, doesn't it? You're not wrong, but you're not right either. It turns out, if you'll bear with me this morning, it's a difficult section to teach, but I think if we pay careful attention, this actually tells us a whole lot about peace and what Jesus has come to do. And I think maybe there's never been a better time than now to hear his message from this text. The first thing that should bother you in the scripture reading that was given to us a moment ago is when Jesus says, I didn't come to bring peace. Like everything else in there is kind of metaphorical and vague. The world's going to burn. There's a baptism I have to be baptized with. You know, okay, well, maybe I can understand that. I came not to bring peace, but division. Well, that's not what we were promised. The Old Testament said that he would be the Prince of Peace, and he would come with healing in his wings and bring peace to the nations, to the peoples, to heal what's wrong with our sin-sick world. Paul, looking back at what he did, said he is going to give us a peace that passes understanding. I am much more at home thinking of Jesus, the peacemaker, than I am of this particular passage. Because it's difficult, I think, to understand what he's saying, and I suspect we've often misunderstood it. The hint that we've misunderstood it actually comes at the end of the passage. Don't stop too early. Read all the way to the end. And in fact, I want to start there. He also said to the crowds, right? This isn't just, here's something else he said. Luke said, here is some more of that. He also said to the crowds, when you see a cloud rising in the west, this is verse 54, you say at once, a shower is coming, and so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you say, there will be scorching heat, and it happens. You hypocrites! You know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? He's telling them right up front, there is something obvious that you're missing. Okay? This isn't a passage making fun of meteorologists, although as Oklahomans, we'd be fine with that. We know that's like the most imprecise of all sciences. But that's not actually the point either. That in reality, humans most of the time are not oblivious to the weather. Right? We heard thunder a minute ago. Who connected the dots already? Right? In your head, you didn't have to get a forecast to know, I heard thunder, I'm thinking rain. right? You put all that together. In Oklahoma, we know if it's really hot outside and really wet outside, trouble's coming in the spring, right? Because that's when the clouds start to do in this number instead of this number, and it gets pretty scary, right? And we kind of have got to where we can interpret that. In their world, they had the same thing. They didn't have the National Weather Service in the first century, it turns out. They had clouds, right? They would go out, and they'd look, and they'd say, well, what's it look like to you? And they got pretty good at it, because people do. You live in a kind of desert climate, you can kind of anticipate when it's going to rain. You can kind of anticipate when it's going to be hot. We are capable, in fact, we are made by God, to be able to look at the evidence, the state of things, and draw conclusions about what's happening. But when it comes to morality, when it comes to society and civilization, when it comes to our own lives, we turn that feature of our brain off. We don't want to look at what's happening and ask too many questions. I don't want to say it's going to rain because that might make it true. Rather than deal with reality of what's happening, we find a way to just ignore what's staring us right in the face. And in fact, we think people that tell us there's a problem are probably the problem. And I think that's what Jesus is getting at. If you go back now and read this text that comes to us from verses 49 through 53. Let me just read it with you again. I came to cast fire on the earth, and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. For from now on in one house there will be five divided. Three against two, two against three. They will be divided, father against son, son against father, mother against daughter, daughter against mother, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. In case you weren't sure, he went ahead and covered it all, right? All the relations. What's he talking about there? If you have been to some of our more recent Sunday night classes that we've had, we've been doing some question and answer, and one of the distinctions I've tried to point out that helps me to understand how to read difficult passages in the Bible is that some passages are what I would call descriptive and some are prescriptive. Now let me reemphasize in case you weren't in those classes what I mean by that. Prescriptive means it's a verse that's telling you, now do this. So on your medicine bottle you have a prescription. Take three times daily with food. And that tells you exactly what you're supposed to do. It's a prescription. Some passages in the Bible are prescriptive. Do not worship idols. What's that? Well, that's a prescription. Don't do that. It says right there on the label, don't do that. Some passages in the Bible, however, are descriptive, meaning they're not telling you what to do. They are trying to tell you what's happening. They are describing a situation and hoping you will draw some conclusions. Most of the Bible is written that way, right? You read the book of Genesis, it's mostly stories. The commands, it has some commands, they're given to other people. Noah was told to build an ark, but we were told a story about a man who built an ark. We have a description. So when I read this passage, an important question is this prescriptive? Is this a prescription? Is it telling me to do something? Or is it a description of what's going on? Is this a prescriptive text? Is it telling me that this is how Jesus wants it to be? I want to suggest to you that it's not. And you get that from the text. He says, I have a baptism to be baptized with, and I am in great distress about it. Is he looking forward to it? Is he saying, boy, I sure hope you crucify me soon? Right? It doesn't seem like he thinks this is the best possible scenario. He is simply saying, this is the way it is. For better or worse, he says, this is what is happening right now. Like a thunderclap or a cloud in the sky, this is the weather. This is what it looks like. And you should be drawing some conclusions about that and what it says about us. What Jesus doesn't name and the people don't understand is the disease behind the symptom. So I'm changing metaphors now, but do you see the point? When you go to the doctor, you list the symptoms. My temperature is this, I feel like this, so forth. That's not actually what's wrong with you. That's describing a set of symptoms. And you want your doctor to be the weatherman to read the description and say, here's the problem and here's what we're going to do about it. And what Jesus, I think, is complaining about in this text is he says, all the symptoms are here. But you aren't looking any deeper than that. What are the symptoms? Well, you can look at them. He lists them. Oops, sorry, go back. There. The world's on fire. That's a metaphor, obviously. He doesn't mean there's a grass fire in southern Judea. What he means is it feels like the world's just burning down. We're starting a fire, and I'm kind of eager for it to get going. I'm tired of waiting. The anticipation's killing me. And what is he trying to describe? There's something wrong on the earth. People looked around at their lives, and they said, this is a mess. He's describing the same sensation you get when you watch the evening news. He said, the world's on fire. Something's wrong. In the verse 50, he says, I'm going to be baptized with a baptism of suffering. By the way, just complete side note off my topic completely, but, you know, I'm back from vacation, so I'm a little riled up. I can preach on stuff that's not my topic. If you ever wanted to know what baptism means in the New Testament, this verse helps you more than any. Jesus is not suggesting that he's going to be christened with suffering, right? Someone's going to pour a little suffering on his head. He means baptism in the way the New Testament always does, in the sense of in immersion. I am going to be dunked in suffering. I am going to be miserably drowned in suffering. I am going to be completely immersed and soaked to the bone in suffering. And he's not thrilled about it. He's consistently not thrilled about it. You go to the Garden of Gethsemane. He says, Father, if there be any way to take this cup away from me, let it be. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. He's not thrilled about it. But he says, I know that suffering is on the horizon. I can see the weather. And then he says, yeah, we've got division instead of peace. Messiah has come. That's what Jesus has been telling him. Messiah has come with healing in his wings, and all you see is division everywhere I go. Something's wrong. Something's very, very wrong. And what Jesus doesn't name, but the people also don't understand, is what is the disease beneath the symptoms. And that's an important concept for us to understand. We need to be the kind of people who look beyond just symptoms and look for the disease. If you come into the emergency room and you say, I'm in a lot of pain, and the doctor says, here's a pain pill, that treats a symptom, but no one thinks that actually fixes anything, right? Do we get that? I know in a world of fast and easy prescriptions, we sometimes fool ourselves in believing that will take care of it, but it really doesn't. There's a problem causing the pain. You go to the ER and you've got a 106-degree fever. Your brain is melting. And the doctor says, we probably ought to cool you down. Well, that's not a bad idea, but I'd kind of like to know why my fever is 106 degrees. Eventually, I can't live in an ice bath for the rest of my life. Eventually, we've got to do something about this fever. What's wrong with me? Christians have to think this way as well, and too often we don't. In our world, we have two kinds of people when it comes to a crisis, a problem. We have policymakers. Policymakers attempt to address the symptoms of our crisis. That's not a bad thing. Remember, if you go to the ER and your temperature is 106 degrees, yeah, they probably ought to do something about that. But we also know that's not enough. When I was writing this sermon, I was thinking a lot about some of the recent shootings and gun violence and things like this. And it occurred to me that both political parties, and if it becomes obvious that I'm disenchanted with American politics, well, it's because I am, both political parties have a policy solution, right? Can I exaggerate them just for a minute so that you know I'm making a point? One party says, if we take away all the guns and the pea shooters and the knives and the butter knives and the spatulas, no one will ever hurt anybody again. The other party seems to think if we all strap assault rifles to our backs, then people will stop hurting each other. Those are terrible exaggerations, okay? I exaggerated both so that you can hate me for both parties, right? Both of those are policy solutions, right? People are killing each other. We don't like it, so what do? Let's make a policy that fixes that. Maybe that's a good idea. I mean, be perfectly honest with you. I don't know what the policy solution is. I hope our legislative body finds wisdom they have never before had and comes up with some kind of policy. I don't even care what it is. I'd like them to all get on the same page, top to bottom, executive, legislative, judicial, that's the one. I've been on vacation. I don't really know words anymore. The judicial branch all get on the same page and say, here's a policy. We're not all sure about it. We're going to give it a shot because we'd like to do something. I'd say, hey, good for you. That's better than talking about it. Great for you. But does anybody actually believe that fixes the problem? I think we all kind of know deep down inside that's a policy. You've treated a symptom. It hasn't fixed the problem. The alternative to being a policymaker is to be a peacemaker. To say there is a problem deep down in the human heart, and we're going to have to do something about that, because that's the disease. You see the difference? There's a big difference. And maybe our government is only equipped to make policies. Maybe the best they can do is to be good policymakers. And I'd like to see them try that. But Christians are equipped to do something more. When Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount that the peacemakers will be called the sons of God, he's saying that is essential to our identity. We have the capacity to bring about a change in the world that is more fundamental than a policy shift, but actually changes the way people think, the way they encounter right and wrong, the way they interact with each other, to actually be more like Christ. Christians have that capacity. Maybe policymakers don't. I think when people looked at Jesus, they saw symptoms. He wasn't getting along with the Pharisees very well. Troublemaker. Wasn't getting along with the Sadducees very well. Troublemaker. Wasn't getting along with the priest very well. Troublemaker. Folks, those are symptoms. The disease question is this. Why is it that no one gets along with the Messiah, the Son of God? What does that say about us? Let me give you another way of thinking about this same question, just with two other words instead. There's a difference between being a peacemaker and a peacekeeper. A peacekeeper attempts to maintain the status quo, even if the peace is really a lie. Talk to a recent veteran sometime who has been on one of those many peacekeeping ventures that we do overseas. I'm not even saying they're bad. Again, I'm actually trying to stay out of politics today. I'm not doing a great job, but I'm trying. I'm not saying those are bad, but ask a veteran who's been in that capacity overseas as a peacekeeper. And anytime I talk to one, they tell me the same thing. We did not have the power to actually make anything better. We were given unclear guidelines to try to keep the status quo, to keep things quiet in hopes that somebody else fixed the problems in the world. That's peacekeeping. And that's probably a good thing. Kind of like policymaking, it's probably a good thing. Somebody ought to do that. But peacemaking is very different. Pilate, the governor who crucifies Jesus, is a peacekeeper. There's a man in Jerusalem who's been causing trouble. The high priest bring that man to him and say, we're about to have a lot of trouble. We'll give you a way out. Crucify that man. He says, I don't want to. He doesn't seem to be guilty of anything. They say, we don't care. If you don't want trouble, get rid of that man. And Pilate says, that's kind of my job, isn't it? His job is not to make the Jewish people better. His job is to keep them quiet, to make sure there are no riots in the streets of Jerusalem. And if that means crucifying an innocent man, he says, I can do that. I'm not fond of it, but it'll keep you hushed. Pilate is a magnificent peacekeeper. He's not a peacemaker. He's not actually attempting to solve the problem. He doesn't say, what kind of people are you that want to crucify a man so good? He doesn't try to bring about reconciliation. He's only looking at the problem on the surface. And let me tell you, that is a theme. If you read the Old Testament prophetic literature, any of the prophets, that is a theme that comes up over and over and over again. That there were people who were in a position of just trying to get along and keep things quiet. And then along comes the prophet. And he says, you're sinning, better quit that. And how do they respond? You remember 1 Kings chapter 18, 17 through 18? Elijah comes to Ahab, the king, and he says, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" He says, "Everywhere you go, Elijah, I've got a fight." Of course, Elijah says it more plainly. "I have not troubled Israel. You have troubled Israel and your father's house because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals." What's the difference? Ahab's talking about symptoms. Everywhere Elijah goes, people get upset. Elijah's talking about a disease. He said, "You left the Lord your God, and that's why you don't like it when I talk." One of them is a peacekeeper. One's trying to make peace by reconciling people to their God. And there is a huge difference between the two. One of the sternest and oft-repeated warnings to prophets in the Old Testament is never settle for fake peace. In Jeremiah, for example, chapter 6, verse 14, he speaks of the false prophets and says, "They have healed the wound of my people lightly, saying, 'Peace, peace,' when there is no peace." What was the crime? Well, they were healing the people, weren't they? He said, "Lightly." Putting a little salve on it. Ignoring the actual problem to tell people everything's okay. He says, that's not peace. So important is this phrase, it keeps getting repeated in Jeremiah 8:11, Ezekiel 13:10, Ezekiel 13:16. Over and over again, the false prophets are blamed because they were the ones that said, "Shh, everything's okay. Don't talk about it." And it was the prophet of God that came to town and said, "We have a problem, and we've got to talk about it. Because if we don't talk about it, we heal the people lightly." I love that phrase, by the way. You heal the people lightly. Got a broken bone? Here's an aspirin. That'll fix it. I guess it's better than nothing, but it's not going to fix anything. And that, I think, is the challenge of so many of these topics we talk about. Paul says that's what we're going to be doing right up till the end of time. It's a common human condition. In describing the end of the world, in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3, he says, while people are saying there is peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. What these passages have shown us is that if we settle for fake peace, we're setting ourselves up for disaster because we're not dealing with the actual problem. True peace might require some conflict. You understand this now when I do a little bit of counseling, not a whole lot, I do a little bit, both premarital counseling and sometimes marital counseling, before the problem and after the problem, premarital and marital, right? One of the things we talk about is conflict is not necessarily a problem. In fact, for premarital counseling, if they say, "We've never even had an argument," I said, "You don't know each other well enough yet. How dare you get married? Go fight about something and come back and we'll figure out if you know each other or not." If you don't care about each other enough to actually have an opinion and disagree on something, what are you thinking getting married? Because you're going to have a fight eventually and you probably ought to figure out how to handle that. Conflict isn't necessarily bad. There are bad ways to have conflict, but dealing with problems in an honest fashion is healthy. And you find out couples who don't do that don't make it. They sit quietly trying to keep the peace while their marriage falls apart. Can I tell you, churches do the same thing on a regular basis. In churches, we can be peacemakers or peacekeepers. We can say, we're going to do the thing that makes the least number of people unhappy at any given moment. We're going to think about what things look like and what they sound like and how we think people might respond to it. Or we can deal with reality. And peacekeeping is always easier. Peacekeeping is always more satisfying. Because you feel like I was diplomatic and we got along and no one's upset with anybody. We're still all upset, we're just not saying it out loud. That's the difference between peacekeeping and peacemaking. Peacemaking says, maybe there's a problem. And maybe we should talk about it. Maybe we should be direct and candid. And actually talk about what's going on. What kind of people are we if we don't? Why do you not know how to interpret the present time? That's the question at the end of this section from Jesus. He wants you to take a serious look in the mirror and not turn away from what you see. Don't be satisfied with a superficial peace. Ask the tough questions. I've been asking some tough questions of myself on vacation. That's what preachers do on vacation, by the way. They sit and think about their problems, right? They sit and think, now the kids are in the pool, but I'm poolside, because you can't read a book in the pool. I don't know if you knew this. So I'm not in the pool. I'm on the, you know, under the big umbrella, right? And we're there, and we got the book out, and I'm thinking about things and thinking about things. And I wonder and I worry about problems that we have overlooked as a congregation rather than actually talked about. Can I give you a couple that I think just ought to be talked about? I had the strange experience the other day of tuning into our live worship stream. You know, in case you didn't know, we're recording our services and streaming it live over the internet so people who are on vacation can tune in later and say, oh, hey, here was the service, and that was nice. And it's a wonderful experience to actually be somewhere else but get to tune in later and say, oh, here's what happened. And it was nice. It was like I was there. Devin gave what I thought was a wonderful sermon. I appreciate him doing that. Had a C.S. Lewis reference and everything. See, I actually listened, right? Gold star. It went about 5 minutes longer than some of you thought it should. And the way I know that is because at the end of the video feed, about 15 or 20 people get up and walk out during the last song because we're past time to get to lunch. And I see the faces of people I know and care about walking out the back door during the closing song. You can't stay for a few more minutes to hear who might be in need of our prayers or what activities we might be doing this week. And I think, what have I been doing here for 9 years? If we think church is something you attend and show up to and get out as quick as possible, rather than listen and think about what is it I should be doing with my time this week in the service of God, it makes me think I haven't been doing a very good job of telling you what Christianity is about. Let me tell you, nobody is more impatient with announcements than I am. Every opportunity I get to cut the announcements down to a bare minimum, I'm the guy like, hey, pare it down, make it shorter, make it shorter. But do you understand one of the reasons we moved the announcements to the end is so we could have the opportunity, a rare opportunity, to have an elder stand in front of you and do the thing elders are supposed to do, to tell you, here are people that need to be prayed for. Here are works that need to be done. Here are concerns that you should have. It is literally the task of eldership. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, there's a word that's mistranslated quite often that talks about elders ruling over the church. Rule is a terrible translation there. The Greek term is prosexime, which means literally stand in front of the church. Their job is to stand in front of you and gather your attention for a few minutes and say, here are some people you should pray for. Here are some works that need done. We find that is the optional extra. We find that is a good time to check out the back door. And that bothered me because it made me think, I have made us comfortable with that behavior, and it shouldn't be. When I look at us as a congregation, it's easy to look at symptoms. That's actually a symptom. There are other symptoms we could talk about. Can I name the elephant that's not in the room? Right? 2 or 3 years ago, we were averaging 200, 220 members on a Sunday morning. More recently, it's 160 to 170. Now, I'm not a numbers guy. Like, when it comes to churches, I like math. I love math. Okay? If everything was a math problem, I would solve the world's problems. But it's not, it turns out. I know that church attendance goes up and goes down, and that's a reality of church life. Anywhere you go. I know that a church full of young families will especially dip in the summertime because people go to Branson on weekends, right? Yeah, totally get that, and I'm okay with that. But I'm also a guy who grew up in small churches, churches of 30, 40, and 50 members. And when I look at a church that over 2 years has somehow misplaced a church's size worth of people, I think something's amiss, but that's a symptom. It's not the disease. It means there is something deep down that we're just not doing well. From the leadership down to the membership, something isn't going quite right. And so we have a couple of options. Option A, never ever talk about it. We could not worry about what the weather might tell us. We could not deal with reality. We could avoid conflict at all cost and hope things just kind of get better. Or we could take that great, terrible, beautiful mirror of the Scriptures and hold it up to our own faces and saying, where am I failing this congregation? How could I do more to help right the ship? What could I do to make us who we ought to be? That's the kind of peace that Christ brings us. Not a peace that looks over problems, but a peace that actually comes to know what peace is by addressing problems. There is nothing more unsettling in the human heart than a lingering problem. Something where you say, I know something's amiss, but I'm going to put it off till tomorrow. And every time you do, you die a little inside. Christ says, that's not peace. And so, yeah, I'm going to burn the world down, he says. Yes, there will be no more superficial peace but division everywhere I go. He says, yes, they're going to kill me for it. Because real peace, real struggle, real growth is worth the price of doing those things. Why in our culture do we have violence rather than peace? I don't think it's because of gun laws one way or the other. I don't think there's a policy that fixes it. I don't think people see gun laws and say, it's this way or it's that way, so I'll kill somebody. Either way. I don't think that's the problem. Something is wrong deep down in the human heart. And our culture has either got to look at it in the face or get used to it. I don't want to get used to it. I'm tired of seeing it on the news. I think we have to talk about it and say, what is going on? Why is the world on fire? Why is our country angry and divided? Why is our civilization angry and divided, bitter and resentful? See, it works on the national level, it works on the church level, it works on the personal level. So here's what we've got to do. Number one, Christians ought to, by which I mean must, work toward reconciliation, not strife. Do not use the I came to bring a sword, not peace verse as an excuse to be ugly to your fellow man. As I quote so often from my professor Jim Baird, don't be a jerk for Jesus, right? The devil's got plenty of mean, ugly people. You don't have to be one. When Jesus says, I came not to bring peace but a sword, he doesn't mean go out and be mean to each other. He's saying that the price of reconciliation will sometimes be enduring some conflict. So Christians work towards conflict, not strife. Christians create peace by fighting the disease, not the symptoms. There are no easy solutions to the problem of your life, to the problem of your church, to the problem of your nation. You want to be popular? Offer an easy solution. Tune in anytime you want to a presidential debate, right? And you're going to get a guy behind a microphone offering the easiest possible solution because people love that and they'll vote for it. Want to be a popular preacher? Give everybody a three-step program that grows the church. That sounds easy. The end. There are no easy solutions. They don't exist. And if you want to feel comfortable about your life, take the easy route. But Christians know it doesn't work that way. No pain, no gain. We fight the disease, not the symptoms. And Christians create peace by engaging conflict as Christians, not avoiding them for false peace. We talk about the things that need to be talked about. We deal with reality of our problems in our homes, in our marriage, with our children, with our church, with our nation, with our country, with our world, with our God. We deal with reality. No more peace, peace when there is no peace. We're going to talk about the truth. So that's my commitment to you. I want to do better about telling the truth. Not because I've been lying. I don't think I have been. But because I think it's important for us to look reality in the face and think about what it means and what we can do about it. What I need from each and every one of you, and more importantly, what God needs from each and every one of us, is to be the kind of people who want to fix those problems, who want to bring peace to the world that's broken and sad, and we're not going to settle for anything less. Start in your own life. If you do not have a relationship with Jesus Christ through faith, through obedience, through forgiveness of your sins, through active membership in a local church, by doing something that makes you more like Christ. If you're not doing that, you do not have peace in your life. And there is no easy route to being able to look in the mirror and sleep at night and do all the things that a peaceful person can do. Instead, you have to make tough decisions. You have to reconcile yourself to God. You have to realize that it takes less of myself and more of Him to be at peace with Him. And you have to change things about yourself that might be painful. But that's how we get peace. Nothing short of that is possible. If you would have the peace that passes understanding, if there's anything we can do to help you with that, we're going to stand and sing the invitation song, and you may come.